sociology, but the sociology did not exist as a science as we know it back then. But he was the father of social Darwinism. That is, it was he, as I point out in the syllabus, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Note this, survival of the fittest was not coined by scientists, not coined by Darwin, it was coined by Spencer. Although Darwin himself was not a biologist, Darwin was a divinity student, I pointed out. And he extended the theory of biological evolution to all of life, including ethics. Spencer, look at this very important statement in the syllabus. Spencer began then thinking about human society as an evolutionary organism. Men began to think about the organization of not only men, not only animals, but also men, not only men individually, but men corporately. Of course, sociology is the study of how men operate corporately, as societies, as groups, whereas psychology is the study of how men operate as individuals. And so the evolution of society, and men begin to talk about societies evolving, the natural evolution of society. You see, Marxism, although it's a socioeconomic theory, assumes that. One of the reasons why communism has been so hard to do, you know, I forget the name of the Indian philosopher who said about communism, that any man who is not a communist before he's 30 has no heart. Any man who is a communist after he's 30 has no head. That is this theory which looks so idealistic, the idea of equality and everybody sharing the material goods of the world and so forth. Sounds very good to untrained minds. One of the reasons why it is so hard to, why Marxism keeps, sustains itself is that younger people keep coming on who buy into this Spencerian dream that if we just get our ducks in a row, society will, get the hindrances out of the way, like capitalism and religion. Get the roadblocks out of the road, then society will naturally evolve itself into utopia.
In the case of the roadblocks out of the road, that's not natural.
Well, what they say is that technology and various other things have created artificial roadblocks. And many are willing to die to remove those roadblocks. Problem is the church is a roadblock. It's like a cancer, you understand? They often use this analogy, that you take a human body and it will naturally be healthy, but if it gets a cancer on it, you've got to go in and artificially remove the cancer in order for it to progress naturally. Well, capitalism and Christianity and everything are cancers, so you've got to get rid of those, do surgery. Then society will be free to follow its natural course, which is what? Evolution for a new class of society for the utopia. You see, now that seems like an old idea. It worked out before the turn of the century, and it still hangs on. My problem is because then the people keep coming on to buy into that debt.
Thank you. said man has no more rights than a rattlesnake. Why? Because man is just no different from a rattlesnake. He just happens to be a little more advanced. Yeah.
But people that hold of that, try to hold of that, you wouldn't find them being causes like sickness or something, because the taking of a whale up to better humans and worse animals is no more wrong than two other animals fighting out. And yet you still see people who claim to be evolutionists, per se, who are wholesome enough, seem to be leading these fights against
this struggle.
In other words, why don't we say, why don't we worry about the Florida Panther? Why would an evolutionist have to worry about that?
That's a minor contradiction. The greater contradiction is why are they against Hitler? That's the great contradiction, something like that.
But now what they've done, to answer your question, Steve, at the beginning of the 20th century, is that whereas in the 19th century, in the turn of the century, the idea was the struggle among individuals. Well, the problem is, some of the individuals who got into the struggle, nobody liked, like Hitler. And so all of a sudden, then the idea, theory is modified just in terms of struggle of groups, not of one group with another group, as some are suggesting this, so that really you have group cooperation, not struggle. And in the long term, it is cooperation that enables you to evolve, make progress. So that we learn that that's something. Well, that's the interesting. Your argument for evolution, evolutionary reflection, we argue people believe the way they can't believe it. Your argument was one of the individual, this was Nietzsche. And Hitler, like Nietzsche, classical hero, the individual. So the individual struggles, Superman, gurus, released in German. The individual struggles, one state, and then this is the next step, is that one state struggles against another state so that the stronger state survives. We got progress. That was a great idea. It worked out very well. Well, now, you read the anthropology text, that's considered bad. Why? Well, we saw what happened. Two world wars and all other stuff. So now it is the idea of universal cooperation, internationalism. Interesting. Anthropology is used to argue for internationalism today. One world government.
We're still the survival of the fittest, which makes all of us.
You see, the old theory, here's the difference. You see, the old social Darwinist theories permitted the struggle of one man against another man, but that was too microscopic, that was too localized. Good. But they would permit the struggle of one state against another state. Now, the fad is to talk about the study of the human race, the struggle of the human race against negative social forces. It's us, the human race is one abstract against another, negative social forces. Like nationalism, this nation is a communist philosophy, and the struggle against this nation, and the struggle, and eventually the national win, and we'll make progress. Well, two world wars, nobody wants to call that progress. No, I'm dreaming all this. So now the idea is that all human race, where you have one nation, but it's set the economy, set the money, approach. Now you need one world, one government, one money, one set of laws. Otherwise, we're going to die. But it's still evolutionary. So that was what we're trying to something else. You may say that it's broader definitions. Well, anyway, we're getting rid of ourselves.
We have grabbed, now, in the area of anthropology, and men like Lothrop Stoddard, Nathaniel Southgate, Shaler, and others developed the evolutionary theory of race. We see it in that, and this prevailed. This was used to justify slavery and to explain a lot of things. For instance, and we said this in cultural anthropology. Here, of course, this course will allow you cultural anthropology.
biology.
Yeah, we had that course underneath.
You see, the idea was that the races of man represented stages of evolution. You got that? That's what the evolutionary theory of race is, the theory, the idea that the races of man represented stages in evolution. And the lowest was the black man. He was the least evolved. The Mongolians were a little more evolved. And of course, guess which race was the most evolved? The white race was the most evolved. Therefore, the black race, you see, was incapable of, and certain races were only capable of certain cultural attainments. For instance, why did we have the Industrial Revolution in Western Europe? And why did the white race become the technological leaders of the world? Answer, because their race is capable of that. They naturally organized complex industrialized societies. Now, the black man, on the other hand, his race only permits him to live a tribal existence, and he's the natural born servant that is used to justify slavery. He was born that kind of life, that's why he's so happy. Why not? Don't you know he's happy? Why look at Watson shuffle his feet and scratch his head and spit watermelon seeds, isn't it? This is the idea of, they changed the words to way down upon the on an old Kentucky home. The original word is, well, the sun shines upon an old Kentucky home, it's summer and the darkies are gay and homosexual. They were happy. Happy all summer that all the darkies are happy. The happy darkies. Well, I just look at him. See how happy he is. Of course, he's born today. He's evolved that far. He's not evolved far enough to be able to enjoy it. So we're doing him a favor, you see. Which, of course, is nonsense, but what's the term mongoloid? What do you call a child? What's the new term for the mongoloid? Down syndrome. You're in my class. We talked this through you, Mr. Michael. Tell you tell us about how where the term mongoloid came from.
They had heavy dialects, and so people assumed that they were evolutionary.
Yeah. Encephalic fold with the mongoloid people's eyes, and the Down syndrome child has something that looks like that. That's the eyes of the Down syndrome child. So it was an evolutionary throwback to the Mongolian period, to the Mongoloid stage of evolution. That's why they couldn't learn slowly. That's where that theory comes from. Now, of course, now we know that's all complete nonsense, but that was science for a long time.
And there were many along those lines. You had, say, in the times of slavery in the 1800s, early 1800s, you still had black men who were very smart, obviously, ability to live a free life in the family. What would they attribute that to?
They ignored them. It didn't exist, really. In history, so much a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know the period that has existed in America from the very beginning, from the colonial period, the black community, very, never been enslaved, always been well educated, professional, but they just didn't exist. Because they understand this evolutionary theory of race. They understand that the black man was most like the monkey. But the problem is, you shave a chimp and he's white. interestingly enough, Michael, tell us which races, the Caucasoids or the Negroids, have the most body hair? Caucasoids do. White people have more body hair and heavier beards than black people do. It's interesting the point is, but that was the theory of race. Then, and this is where it touches us, Oliver Wendell Holmes became the legal Darwinist. You see what I'm trying to teach you? All the different areas of thought, of intellectual endeavor, where Darwinism, which admittedly failed as a theory of biology, was accepted as good science by other, in this philosophical urge to get away from God, really. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, this is very important to our own history. Oliver Wendell Holmes is the great legal Darwinist. His favorite author, or one of his favorite authors, was the fellow too, with a couple of lines up, William Graham Sumner. And what he said is Oliver Wendell Holmes first died in 1934. His father, Oliver Wendell Holmes I think this is Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., was the Civil War physician and poet. It was his son who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. You understand that? He's the legal guardian. He's very recent. I see, died in 1934, if my memory does not fail. Now, he said, see, if man is what Darwinism suggests he is, or evolution suggests he is, if man is, and here's the key statement, here's how to think about this, how to word this. If man is animal, that and nothing else. And if society, so if man is evolving individually, and therefore society is evolving collectively, therefore, what is the function of law? You see, under our, a lot of people don't realize this, that we know that America is no longer under, we're no longer a constitutional republic. That is, we're no longer guided by the Constitution. Constitution, our other foundational documents, are built on the assumption of man as creation of God. Here's the fundamental assumption in the legal founding of our country with this. That since man is a creation of God, he has certain rights which are inalienable, that's the word you use. That they are his intrinsically. They are his, not because they are his by the very fact of his nature. They are not granted by government. Understand? Man has certain basic rights which are not granted by the state. They are granted, they are his by the nature of his creation. Man, yes, the wording is, endowed by his creator with certain inalienable rights. Y'all got that? Therefore, what is the function of law? What is the function of government? The function of government is to protect those rights and preserve them. Now, that is the theory upon which our country is fixed. It is the law functions. Law functions to preserve intrinsic rights. Now, but what if it is no longer possible, in your view or in man's view, to view man as a creation of God and therefore owning certain inalienable rights? What if man is an animal that nothing else? What if William Graham Sumner is right? Remember Holmes, like to read Sumner? What if Sumner is right? He built a social theory based on Darwinism, that man has no more rights than a rattlesnake, because man is an animal, that and nothing else. What does that do to law? What does law become? Well, Holmes tried to work that out. He tried to articulate a theory of law to fit the new concept of man. It's called legal Darwinism. His view was that law functions to legitimize the proper evolution of the state. That the state will evolve in a somewhat natural way, and that law comes after the fact to make legal, to give form and order, legality, to that which the state naturally does. So, Arthur Wendell Holmes championed the rights of the individual. He's known for that. Championed the rights of, but hear me, it's misunderstood. The question is not whether Holmes, as a matter of fact, championed the rights of the individual. The question is upon what basis or for what reason did he champion the rights of the individual. Holmes held that in most circumstances, their individual rights must be preserved because that the preservation of individual rights promoted the proper evolution of the state, not because the man had intrinsic rights. Are you with me? It's one thing to say that a man's individual rights must be preserved because he's a creature of God, he's a person, he's not just an animal. It's something else to say a man's individual rights must be preserved because, not because those rights are intrinsic or inherent, but because it is the preservation of those rights promotes evolution, the proper evolution of the state. As far as intrinsic rights, Holmes, and I'm quoting him now, this is his version of what William Graham Sumner said. Holmes said that man has no more basic or inherent rights than a baboon or dust or dirt. Okay? So that man has no more basic rights than a baboon or dirt. That is, in the Holmesian view, if the preservation of individual rights or what are conceived to be individual rights hinder the proper evolution of the state, then those rights not only can be taken away, they must be taken away. They are not intrinsic. They do not exist in and of themselves. They have no inherent defensibility. Y'all see the difference? Now, so that whereas before, law, the theory of law, and this is what the documents of our republic say. The documents of our republic imply and assume that law functions to reflect an absolute standard, the ultimate absolute standard being God. That is, laws are to tell us what is right and what is wrong. By an absolute standard, absolute morality. And therefore to preserve man's individual rights. But you see, law, under Holmes, law functions to simply codify after the fact what society comes to in its natural evolution, not to state what that evolution should be, not to give absolute line, not to establish absolute morality. You see that parenthetically. Often you'll have, anytime anybody doesn't like the law, they'll say two things. They'll say, well, you can't legislate morality. Which is absurd. Law, not only can you legislate morality, that's all law does. Law does nothing but legislate morality. It's the function of law. The second thing they say is, well, it's not enforceable. You should take the laws against marijuana off the books. Why? Because it literally depends on the hip stop marijuana. And, prohibition failed. I mean, everybody knows prohibition failed. So, it did not fail at all. You check. Prohibition didn't fail at all. Prohibition succeeded magnificently. It's taken off the books, but everybody wants to drink. And, understand? Of course, there was a lot of illegal liquor traffic. But you go back and see what happened. See the cost of how the cost of law enforcement went down. Do you know how many mental institutions were closed in the prohibition era? The mental health business is not made out of this, it's just about. Counties saved, government saved huge amounts of money in law enforcement, school dropouts went down, and child abuse went down. Yeah, prohibition succeeded magnificently. That wasn't anything like that. But anyway, we all know that prohibition failed, so it did not. But that argument, of course, takes all laws off the books. If you're going to take the laws off the books because they don't stop what they're supposed to stop, you wouldn't have any laws. If you don't think that's true, you get on I-4 and see how and drive the speed limit and get run over. At any law. But the reason people advance these theological arguments against particular laws is that they've accepted the Holmesian victim of the purpose of law. You see, what people don't realize is that laws don't only govern behavior. Laws define a culture. They define society. That is, laws not only govern behavior, they describe what kind of people we are. In terms of absolute standards. You understand? That's the laws do that. Well, anyway. Now, let me trace this. Let me take another step further. That's what I started on this. We're going to this about as far as we're going to get from histological science. But I think it's important to see this. That why are we in the legal mess we're in? Why did I say we're no longer in the Constitution? Because, you see, when Holmes is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, his theory of law became the new theory of law, which is the prevailing theory of law. Our present Supreme Court, in its majority decisions, operates under Holmesian law, legal Darwinism, not constitutional law. Now, and this set up, of course, a contradiction if we have a federal judiciary now that operates not on the basis of the thinking of those who wrote the Constitution, not Madison and Jefferson and those fellows, But you have a constitution, a federal judiciary that whose mentor is Oliver Wendell Holmes. And by the way, I'm not making this up. You can just ask them, they'll admit this. I'm not mudslinging. Then, what about the original Constitution? What do you do with the Constitution, to put it bluntly, if you have a federal legal system, and that's not just the Supreme Court, it's the whole federal court system. If you have a federal legal system that is based upon, which contradicts the Constitution, what do you do with the Constitution? Well, no, you can amend it. But Congress amends it. And so you don't amend it legally. What you do is you amend it illegally. You amend it through interpretation. It's interesting how the liberals, every time somebody wants to suggest a constitutional amendment, they just pitch a hissy. They just fall over themselves saying, oh, we can't do that. Why? The Constitution is sacred. The reason they don't want the Constitution to be amended legally is because they've been amending it for a long time illegally. How do they do that? Illegally in a philosophical sense. Now, what they do is, what you do is you take what's called a revisionist view, a non-constructionist view of the Constitution. What you do is you state the proposition that the meaning of the Constitution has no connection with the language of the Constitution. You got that? That the meaning of the Constitution has no connection with the language of the Constitution. Big debate going on now between Brenner and Ed Meese, our Attorney General. Attorney General wants, he's a constructionist, he wants the Constitution to be interpreted by the meaning of the language. Brenner, debating, wants the Constitution to be interpreted in the light of present social needs. And so in order to get over this problem of a constitution that assumes man is a created being with inalienable rights, and this new Holmesian legal Darwinism, there is adopted the view of the Constitution that constitutes a living document, that's one of the favorite phrases, so that we interpret the Constitution to mean not what the language means, but in terms of what's called public policy. That's the phrase, public. What is public policy? Public policy is what Oliver Wendell Holmes did when he talked about the proper evolution of the state. Public policy. So that today, we will amend the Constitution not by doing it legally, in the appointed way, only the Constitutional Convention, and not even elected representatives, the Congress amendment. We will amend it by changing the meaning of the words to fit modern needs. And, for instance, Charles Evans Hughes, who came after, immediately after Holmes, said, the Constitution says whatever the Supreme Court says it says. Earl Warren in the 60s, who did such violence to the Constitution, his court, the Warren Court in the 60s, Earl Warren said, and I quote, the Supreme Court is a continually sitting constitutional convention. This means, he's really admitted, we are not interpreting the Constitution, we are writing a Constitution. The Supreme Court is a continually sitting constitutional convention. And Wren, who represents the modern court, says, the question is not what does the Constitution say, the question is what does society need? So that now, and by the way, this is, therefore, we are not under, listen to me, we are not under constitutional law, we are under sociological law. And that is why we are no longer in the Constitution. It does not matter what the Constitution says. The modern court will play games with the language, pretend with the language, with no intention whatever of being bound by the language of the Constitution, and make whatever law they want, or counsel whatever that law they want, if it serves, quote, public policy. Which means we are no longer a republic, we are an oligarchy, we are ruled by the
the majority vote of the Supreme Court. See, because John Marshall and Alexander Campbell debated in the Virginia Constitutional Convention. John Marshall later became the Supreme Court Justice, and he enunciated the principle of judicial review, which says, it's not the Constitution, but says that what Congress is not permitted to do at the federal level, the states are not permitted to do. Therefore, you cannot have a state law that contradicts a federal law. Therefore, any law passed by a state legislature is subject to judicial review in the federal courts. Which means that it doesn't matter what Congress passes or what the state legislature passes, or what law they pass or don't pass, if the majority votes of the Supreme Court doesn't like it, it's not law.
Does the majority vote of the Supreme Court truly represent the majority of the
Supreme Court? Sure
doesn't. Is that theory, though?
No, it's not the theory.
Do you have any claim there?
Their job is to decide, see, before the job of the Supreme Court, even after judicial review was established by John Marshall, which is not constitutional, which is state, came to be de facto, even after the, for a long time, there was an attempt to be constitutional, but the modern court says their job is, before judicial review and shortly thereafter, the Supreme Court saw as their job to interpret the Constitution. Now, that's that. They no longer interpret the Constitution, they do what's good for public policy. Here's some examples. For instance, Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of religion. Everybody knows what that means. Every member of the Supreme Court knows what that means. And every member of the Supreme Court knows that the original Congress wanted to encourage religion in public life, in public institutions. They established the chaplaincy system. They established that the president has to be sworn in with the Bible, his hand on the Bible. They wanted to encourage religion. Everybody knows that the Constitutional Fathers intended to encourage religion in public institutions. But they wanted to draw the line at having a federal church. When that statement was written, Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of religion, the different states, many of them already had state churches. And they wanted to keep their state churches in their local states. They just didn't want the federal government to establish a federal church that would put their state churches out of business, man. That's all that meant. And the law said that Congress shall make no law to prevent the free expression of religion. Now, there's no question what the Constitution says. But in order to bridge this gap, here's an example now. The Warren Court, and the court sent, Warren Court said, what established means is encourage. They simply change the word, in effect. Instead of having the Constitution say what it really says, that Congress shall not establish their religion in the federal church, they says, we think for the good of society, we wish that the Constitutional Fathers had said, Congress shall make no laws encouraging the religion. Therefore, since we're just going to pretend that we're going to say that that's what it means, encourage, it's changed literally, actually, de facto, but word. So that now it is unconstitutional to encourage religion in public institutions. Isn't that cute? Why? It's good public policy that religion not be encouraged in public institutions.
That can even be accepted in semantics of the word, because encourage, all right, fine, the federal government can't encourage it, but they shall not be against it either.
Well, the point is, eventually that will not have chaplains in the Senate, or military chaplains, or any of that. Why? Because it's a public institution. See, what is a public institution? It's more about public money. You see, public institutions, public money is in almost everything. So that, you see what I'm saying? If you ask them, did the founding fathers want to exclude religion? Did the founding fathers want to discourage religion in public institutions? Nobody says that they did. Understand? There's no suggestion that they did. We don't care that what the founding fathers what the Supreme Court says is, we do not care what the Constitution says. It is our opinion that public policy is best served by this idea. And then they hypocritically say, well, it's constitutional, unconstitutional law. You can understand that? Now they know that. But you ask Brennan about that, he says, if he will tell you straight out, it does not matter what the Constitution says. It is the job of the Supreme Court to promote public policy. That's how Bob Jones lost out on this suit of the IRS. And I don't agree with their racism. But Bob Jones proved that their prohibition against interracial dating, that it was a religious conviction, had always been a religious conviction. And the federal courts agreed that they had that Bob Jones had proved that it was a religious conviction. But nevertheless, they lost their status with the IRS because even though it was a genuine religious practice, it violated public policy. Whatever happened to freedom of religion? And of course, there was no plaintiff in that court. You see, no black people complained. They knew the rules when they went in. Now we agree that's school policy, understand? But what about the Constitution? Really on the Constitution. And they play all kinds of games. For instance, they want to get very constructionist when it suits them, when they want to get their gun control. The right to bear arms? Oh, but you see, they'll say, in the original, all they meant by that was you could have a state militia. Which is true, except that you would have an army so you could serve in the militia. But all of a sudden they get very, you see what I'm saying? When it suits them, what they talk about hypocrites, they get very constructionist. And of course, this is why the babies are dying at the rate of 1.5 to 1.7 million a year. What happened to the right to life? You see, the reason, regardless, where does all this nonsense come about? The states have no vested interest in the first trimester, and only a limited interest after this first trimester. Is that, anybody read the Constitution? Is any of that in there?
No.
There's nothing to do with what. And they say, well, they play games. They say, well, personhood only exists post-labor. Therefore, the Constitution doesn't protect the babies because they're not a person yet. You know, 5 minutes before the birth is not a person, and 5 seconds after the birth it's a person. Which is absurd, of course. They know it's absurd. Or, and this is my favorite for absurdity, the mother's right, that they discovered in the 14th Amendment the right to privacy. In the 14th Amendment. It's a mother's right to privacy. Privacy of her body. That's a begging question. By that argument, you see, a mother can beat your wife to death or beat your kids, but as long as you do it in the privacy of your bedroom. You lock the door. See, our laws in general recognize that if a policeman stands before a locked door and he hears what he believes to be somebody murdered, being murdered behind that door, he not only has the right, he has the legal duty to break down that door. Why? Because the right to life overpowers the right to privacy. The right of the victim to live overpowers the right of the murderer to privacy. You understand that? Except in abortion. Then the right of the baby to live is outmoded by the mother's right to privacy. Of course, that's all absurd. And they know it. They did that. That's window dressing. The reason the babies are dying is because the majority, in its majority vote, the Supreme Court has determined that society is better off with dead babies. You see, too many kids are living. That is, too many unwanted babies for whatever reason. Society is better off without unwanted babies. Understand? That is the decision. Because we know that society is better off with unwanted babies, without unwanted babies. Since society is better off, the proper evolution of society will be gone properly without all these babies around, then it becomes constitutional. Any time the language of the Constitution says that the right of privacy or personhood is sent to women, and they know it. They're arrogant. Which, of course, means nobody's there. You see what I'm saying? So we have no, because of legal darkness, because of all our window homes, we no longer have any constitutional protections. In other words, do we have some constitutional protections? Yes, but only because the preservation of those rights is in the best interest of society.
As soon as those rights become a hindrance to society, those rights will be gone. You'll see what I'm saying? But it's a general theory of law in society. It's Darwinism. And that's where we are. That's why a lot of people don't realize that. What are we going to do when, and by the way, we have exactly the same legal system in the philosophical sense as Soviet Russia. We have exactly the same ground. It's exactly the theory of the way Soviet law works. There is no difference between Soviet law and American law in its philosophical framework, only in its particulars. You understand that? There's no difference whatever. So that, what's going to happen when somebody, when the majority of the Supreme Court decides that Christianity hinders the proper evolution of the state, as is true in Russia, as was true in Nazi Germany, which was Darwinist, see, or in China? What happens, you say? What happens when we become a hindrance to public policy? When it becomes bad public policy to allow such a superstition to exist? See what I'm saying? Now you say, well, it can't happen. Why not? Hitler started out killing the babies, not the Jews. Anyway, do you understand that? But this is legal Darwinism. Whereas the state is seen to evolve, and man is an animal, that is nothing else. But where does the law fit into this? That's what I'm trying to teach you. And now we are not under Madison and Jefferson and Monroe. We are under Holmes, Hughes, Warren, and Brennan. And they're different animals. Okay, did that make sense to y'all? That's the legal Darwinism. Now, Karl Marx, very quickly. Karl Marx, well, I'm going to say a few things about that, but I'm only going to have a minute left. That'd have our guest with us today. Nice.
Thank you. Personal experience with the journey was that it's slightly varied from the Constitution. The main thing is while the Islamic spirit has a lot of work on theology, you call my son up. You know, congregation of lies,
nature
stream to be thought of as not stream status, the Newtonian sense, but the dynamic process. The Newtonian universe has been discussed. The Darwinian new concept, nature is in flux, flow, process. This is a genuine revolutionary law. Interacting forces in organic interdependence. The environment assumes to do with those mountains. The environment affecting him to create all in God. What creation is to the environment of? The rule of law, that is, maximum variation to preserve lawful determinism reigning in new biology. That is, these possibly became the new laws of nature, laws of perfection. That is, here's the point, that nature is in flux, and there are certain forces governing the speed of change and the direction of change, the character of change. And these cannot be avoided. Everything, therefore, must be thought of evolutionary. Everything must be thought of in terms of change, from the simple to the complex, trinity to body. Old is simple, new is complex. Old is less adapted, new is better adapted. And these cannot be changed. The laws of evolution. Nature includes man and his culture, that is, the animal ancestry of nature. Then that human culture could be analyzed in the category of biology, which is what we're in vast reduction, vast oversimplification. That is, and this was Darwin. Talk about the origin and significance of the law in the same category, we talk about the origin and significance of man. And the difference between the one and the three. Man, the animal, the highest. Here's the interesting thing, man is the highest animal. And it's the only animal that evaluates the whole evolution. Man is the animal, that one. Well, I've already introduced to you the failure of Darwinism in the physical science. Darwin's natural selection could explain it seems the survival of the fittest, but it could not account for the arrival of the fittest. Darwinism explains the transformation of species, but not the creation of species, and more with the process of natural selection work. Darwin's theory, he had a theory about it, he recognized it. Understand that you can Darwin said this explains very well why. In one part of the world, birds, one kind of finch, one part of the, one environment, one kind of finch would survive and dominate, whereas another kind of finch would survive as well. So you could not explain the finch. He theorized that the body sends particles to the blood as messengers to the gonads or sexual reproductive structure. That is, this is very remarkable. As body organs change their environmental influences, so would the messenger particles. See, this is Lamarckism. Got that? Mm-hmm. Body organs would change, so, in other words, it's like if when the finch needed a certain shape of beak to eat, somehow this need would be translated into a cause. And these particles somehow would be transferred to the spectral reproduction of the flow that has been in the original hospital. And the food would be better. Or, to be more exact, then that would equip the organism of the thing with kind of structure that would be more efficient. No, very vague about it. But if you recognize this is the market, they take a fall back on the theory of the acquired language that the form of that. You get the arrival of the Francis Galton, Francis Galton, here's the interesting thing. They got very scientific. Galton, 2 years there, I was working, that's right, 1911. He tested Darwin's theory by injecting blood in male rabbits and one color and female rabbits in another color. Yes, he did that. we'll try to change the color of the offspring by trying to change the color of retina by transferring blood. It's now it's viral. Because the blood circulates will carry these particles, whatever the love, and all they got was love, upset rabbits. Well, that work reminds me of the old book, Darwin's theory is ridiculous. Darwin's theory is that the offspring would have cone colors that can be in between those of parent blood donors, because they would receive a mixture of messenger particles. It didn't work. Now, silly, it didn't work. Darwin at the end of his life returned to the basic, the vital fluid that we do that preserve organization in the organ. That's why, listen to me, this is why Darwin is a failure of the biological theory. Notice only about biology. Then came your friend of mine, Gregor Mendel, and look at him for years, his work was going on more or less contemporaneously with Darwin's. But like this is often the case, the implications of his discoveries for the theory of evolution were not appreciated until about 30 years or 40 years later. Gregor Mendel proposed a theory of change through hereditary gene called traits or gene. He's the guy that knows the term gene and mutation. Gregor Mendel. Although Mendel's work was published in 1865, it went unnoticed until 1900. When Hugo de Vries and others rediscovered and confirmed his findings, mutation. Now, that is as opposed to this one, the Lamarckian scheme is for the body to acquire characteristics like the long neck and so forth. And to somehow transmit this to the reproductive organs. So the change takes place where? The change takes place in the neck or in the extremities or in whatever part of the body. And this change is transmitted somehow through fluid, through particles or whatever, to the reproductive organs and to the offspring. One of these changes. Mendel said no. The change takes place in the reproductive system, in the genes, we call it. Somehow change takes place there. And and it has nothing to do with acquired characteristics. It was found, however, that a single mutation usually results only in a slightly or barely perceptible modification of a phenotypic characteristic. That is, the gene produces very, what he called the gene mutation. By the way, mutation is simply the Latin word for change. Okay? It means change. So a change, I'm not sure how. But it was observed that these genetic changes were very slight. That if you got large genetic changes, if you got trees and you got Then, look at how late the dates are. The author, in the research of August Weissman, destroyed Lamarckianism. That is, he planted the tombstone of Lamarckianism. He demonstrated the inability of biological form to transmit acquired characteristics of offspring. It was noticed that variation arising from mutation is removed by the purifying force of natural selection that rejects the fittest type. This is called a stabilizing selection. Therefore, natural selection proceeds antithetical to variation, and the genetic basis for evolution is unsubstantiated. Therefore, we see for a while, they thought, well, this is going to be the answer. But
it didn't work out. Why? Because their simple observation was that that natural selection tended to weed out the mutation, not to encourage it. You have that is natural selection, but the mutation, see, every mutation that they saw was a negative. And you can induce mutations like a mule, but they tend to be sterile, or there's something what's now called a Hardy-Weinberg that is reversion to type. It's observed that when it's mineral at the work of plants, you can induce changes and variation to guide it to natural eugenics or selective breeding or whatever. But if you just left them alone, what happened? Everything would act in time. So that failure, that is natural selection, seemed to work against. Well, the turn of the century, here's where things stood. Darwin, evolution was an unshaken faith among the new biologists, but there was skepticism and agnosticism on the subject of the magnetism. This, the theory of evolution by natural selection was held in Boasting between 1900 and 1925. Now we'll come to the 20th century and see the agnostic theory of 19. So, between 1900 and 1925, and this later, this was the agnostic period of evolution. Until it was restored. So that Mendel, so we have the theory of evolution, and Darwinism at the stake, you have the return of Lamarckianism, then the whole phrase by Lord Mendel, and then the theory of agnosticism. And what's the general feeling was, we know that it happens, but we have no idea how. Well, that's a philosophical assumption. We are utterly, and by the way, this has been the fate of evolution ever since. Because we're going to see that the method, the mechanism is changing now. That is what we're going to see that neo-Darwinism, looking ahead, has settled in on the theory after the period of agnosticism. Doesn't happen. We're going to see what we've always been, that is, utter philosophical, blind, religious faith, that will happen. But mysticism and superstition concerning how it will happen. That is what given enough time, anything can happen in the past. Given enough time, the future will figure out how. Just don't give up on it. We're going to figure that out. Oh, so lose it down. Let's be right. Now, one of the things you must understand is that we talk about Darwin's theory of particles. Marx's early theory of good is translated change to this theoretical relation. You have to understand, this is very important, that one of the that the science of the period, and you all learned from the science of the period, was both for and against evolutionary science, if you want to call it that. In this way, there was not the science of the period did not have the technology of observation. That is, they had no way of. This is one of the most important advances, by the way. It's a fairly recent development of what's called the electron microscope. Before the electron microscope, nobody really had. When you start talking about particles and things like that, even atoms, they were so tiny. That you couldn't tell, couldn't see. What I'm saying is that methods of observation and examination were very crude. Well, see, this, how does this work for and against the theory? Well, it works against the theory in that it's hard to work out, it's hard to prove the theory, but you can't observe it. And observe how things work. They were part of the period in that because things could not be examined, they could not be proven, but they could not be disproved either. So that it allowed for, and this is very important to understand the history of the theory, it allowed for the free play of imagination. And one of the areas in which you see this is the idea of spontaneous generation. You want spontaneous generation. Spontaneous abiogenesis, life and not. That theory, you see, sounded a whole lot better in 1890 than it does in 1990. Why? You see, because of the limited methods of observation and experimentation, examination, testing, nobody had any real appreciation for the complexity of biological form. That is, what we call life is seemingly complex. And the interdependent and specialized, what it takes to provide the biological functions that we generally call, were greatly unappreciated. The complexity was unappreciated because nobody had a way of seeing how complex they were. We ended up in what we call the DNA of the helix, the double helix, involved in that. So, you can see that the basic theory of evolution, which I constantly repeat in the introduction, is understanding from its history. It was worked out at a time when it was allowed the free play of imagination and it allowed these simplifications. That is, when life was conceived of by everyone as being infinitely more simple, the biological processes, biological forms were conceived of as being infinitely more simple, less complex than they really are, then it seemed to be more reasonable to speak of such things as spontaneous generation. And mutations that are producing the changes, that kind of thing. Now, as we're just beginning to appreciate the complexity of life, the idea of spontaneous generation is something that we to talk analogy, you know, one thing to do the thing, but a pencil happening to exist in something else, and then there's a computer happening to sound. Did you see that this is one of the most amazing things in all microatomic that they actually show the perception of both processes physically back in the beginning? Sperm traveling on and go out in the air. And all that has to happen is the sequence. The release of chemicals along the line. And these points of complex chemistry has to take place. The right time, in the right order. And unbelievably complicated chemical sequences have to be followed. So that the idea of happening once, have everything's there, amazing. The idea that it's happening, the whole system actually becomes resistant is ridiculous. But it's almost unbelievable that it happened after that everything's there. And you got my point. I want you to see, I'm kind of sneaking a peek into the 20th century, but I want us to see how the theory could gain respectability early on. That's nice.
Anyway, the Time Magazine has a popular version of this, that the person, the process after the egg is fertilized, the cell division begins. We now know, as a good example, that something else, that knowledge was not known in 1890 or 1910. There could not have been known, because there was not the method of not equipment to see it. But we now know, there wouldn't be an example of compression. We now know, figure it out, home is what's the principle behind the home? That's the word that in the original. What is the principle behind the home? How is cloning theoretically possible? How can we even conceive that? What is true about the human? That's my question today. What is true about the human cell?
Not about cell division, but we're looking at that one cell from someone who is living, but then we know we couldn't explain any of it.
No, it's not about that. That's true, but not that big. What is there about the human cell that's cloning theoretically possible? Okay. All the material. See before, right? Before it was thought that I cells were one kind of cell, but basically, you know, hair is another kind of cell, the skin is another kind of cell. That you can take any cell of the model, you can cut off the end of the hair. They just straighten up the thumbnail. And you guys can break that into a cell in the thumbnail. That cell has in it all the genetic information that the whole thing is. That cell contains the genetic information that it can just be turned on. That's the chemical process. Which is determined by the information contained in the cell. The genetic information is there to make a whole other person out of one cell on the thumbnail. If you can figure out how to turn it on, the whole information is there. Each cell of the human body contains all the information necessary to make the whole, make an exact unit of you. So when the cell divides, you start with the first cell in the egg, is fertilized by the sperm, right? And so it divides, so you got two identical cells, right? Each contains all the information on the cells divide. See what happens is that the half the information comes from the sperm, the other half from the egg, and they unite, they form this new person. And then as this cell divides, each time the cell divides, it contains all the information that the M cell has. All the genetic information is all there, the potential is there. So that, theoretically, you can take any cell in the body and turn it into a chemical signal to turn it on to produce nutrition. Now, so in science fiction, we're talking about the person born and be cloned for spare parts to the older, and then the body will be rejected from the EU. That's cloned for the regulations of the day long, and you're living with that. But, great ethics involved, but they're not very focused on the people. Anyway, now, you understand that principle? That every cell body can get all the information so they can over it. I want to know a question about that. Only you can do that in a very low level.
But I was going to ask what forms it takes in the
world. It probably doesn't tell you at all, so I think. Salamanders are very simple.
They call it the infant, whatever it is, they come out
of that. They grow the laboratory,
and then it goes to the soul. So if they could call me, it would take a number of years for them to call me to a lot of study, but
they like to the same result that they want to have. Yeah. Evan Bursa said, only one time that Bellegate Thomas now is
technology is so complicated.
Anyway, that's my point. That doesn't mean I'm holding. But here's this. Now, so that when, what happens though, what, how does one cell become an eyeball, part of the eyeball, and one cell becomes the leucomia? As the fetus, the zygote, becomes the fetus, and the person becomes the baby, the person, the baby. Well, interesting thing. This division starts. There's more information in that cell than all the computers, and that's 10,000 times over. And so it starts out and it tells, okay, now you sell the whatever there is in there, the shared information is all chemistry. Says that, okay, you want your cells up there, you're gonna make 20 eyelashes. So all your eyelash cells are gonna turn it on certain cells to make the right number of eyelashes, the right number of order. And they fill out those cells in the eyelash group. And just in the right place at the right time, and you shut it off. This thought is going to be left here alone. One cell will travel through the expanding mob, zygote, and it will evolve. It will lay a chemical for the other cell and turn it on. A certain chemical is turned off on the right shape. All that chemical trail around colonized, and then it will form like the ear, the finger, and the right hand will shut off. And this is they get birth, they get birth to that. And that's when something breaks down, this communication, you get birth to that. Baby born without a thalidomide.
Sympathetic, real sympathetic, but
for this, because that is why. You understand why is a reduction system. And so that is why. Listen, you understand why modern theory of evolution, programs organic matter, such as evolution. What it does is it ends up being reductionist, well, because then it can do that chaos. I mean, it is a theory that has been worked out, a basic skeleton of the theory of evolution. You could not
respond to these questions. You could not say that.
And every attempt to make it embrace these theories ends up being reductionist. That is, if I said before, if the theory of evolution is for it to be true, the biological order would have to be much less complicated than it is. Can you help me think about it? The concept.
This is really what's going on.
Well, so, that is, so in this period of agnosticism, it was pretty good at philosophical prejudice. Philosophical prejudice, that is, we see, they said, well, we know that it happened, we don't know how it happened. But listen, what I'm trying to teach you is, they can hang on to that way of thinking. Well, you see, all along, evolutionists, and I'm generalizing now, have given this approach to, as the approach of creationism. Right from Darwin on, you would have heard of it. I call it the lick of the promise, in that approach. It's like this. You say, well, we know that it happened. We know exactly how it happened. That's free. You know, the theory of the lick of the promise, I grew up saying, the lick of the promise, I grew up in the farm. All it is the lick of the promise. That means final adjustment, you know, one more board or two in the structure, and it's done. All that, you know, the lick of the promise means it's all been done. In its basis, it's worked out, a few minor details, and it'll all fall in place. Okay? And that is the impression that has been given. And that is the message that has been conveyed when the creationists, from the 19th century on, when creationists, biblical creationists, have pointed out the deficiencies, they have defended this all along and still are. Well, you see this in the National Geographic editorial, I saw this in the letter to the editor, the Simple Star, a few years ago. All the no question that it happened. We've got a few minor details to work out yet on how it happened. But that doesn't affect the overall acceptance of the theory. And what's happened is that the gap between that it happened and how it happened has not shrunk since the 19th century because of this growing awareness of complexity. The gap has spread. That is, it needs a few more licks and promises now than it did in 1925. You have that? The idea, well, we're just about there. We know now that it happened, and there's just a few more secrets to unlock, a few more mysteries, just a few more observations. Just give a little more time, and we'll finish her off. And that's absolutely false. Understand? That is, the problems have not decreased, is my point, since the turn of the century. They have, not only have they not decreased, they have increased. And not only have they increased, they have increased exponentially. That is, they have multiplied, times themselves, they exploded. That's why so many today are dead now. You see, so looking this, but you see the textbook is what I call textbook evolution. You're still getting this like the promise approach. All is true, we don't know exactly how it happened, but we have a basic thing worked out, which is not true. And we know that's something that we have less certainty all the time. My point is, it is easy. It was easier to say, well, you know what happened. That's exactly how we'll get that. That was easier to say that than 1920. Well, if God is open to it, to the brilliant success of Darwin in other areas. In the 19th century, we
come to further center, we have been discussing the last 2 days the failure of Darwinism as a theory of biology. That is, Darwinism, the reason it was given by the biologists themselves, was going to limbo. It is a 25-year period called the period of agnosticism. So while there was huge doubt, not about the fact of evolution, but about the method, the mechanism of change, you understand? Apparently not being said about the reality of evolution. That is philosophically entrenched and have been for a century before Darwin. But there was great doubt about this and despair even about the prospect of coming up with an explanation of how the method of change. This agnosticism reigned only in biology, and not in Darwinism. This is one of the great ironies of the history of modern history of science. The great irony is that the theory, which was doubted by a theory of biology, which is what Darwinism is, that was what Darwinism said, a theory of biology that was not accepted by the biologists, was accepted as a basis, as a biological basis for everyone else. The social sciences, political science, and so forth. This is very critical to understanding the history of science. Understand that? It was assumed that biology, biological order, was foundational. Yet upon this foundational theory, it didn't work, but biologists seemed to work for everyone else. Because it was, here we see the philosophical, not only the philosophical history of the theory, but the philosophical heritage of the theory. And let me just say that evolution has always worked better as a social theory and a philosophy and a theology than it has worked as a science. And I have found this when I was at university. That I found, I had some of my colleagues who were not my cognitive field is anthropology and evolution, but I chose that. I had some of my colleagues who chose their cognitive field, not the scientists.